The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Every one of us has a unique set of talents and often takes technology to be the vehicle for that expression. Imagine if Hitchcock or Lucas had been born 1,000 years before cinema. What would have been lost? So we have a moral obligation to increase the amount of possibilities in the world.
This is Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, a love letter to science fiction and the fans and creators who made it so, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. I'm Adam Savage, and my guest today may live in this reality, but he has big opinions about all of the others. Founding executive editor of Wired Magazine, Kevin Kelly. My friend Kevin has been a writer, film, and television consultant, photographer, and go-to guru for decades, exploring the place where technology and society meet. He spent his entire career thinking and writing about science and culture, first at the Whole Earth Catalog, the seminal counterculture magazine, and then at Wired Magazine. Kevin and I dissect his uniquely protopian views, how he worries about humanity's unhealthy obsession with the future, and how he's waiting for the day VR includes body switching. So, plug in and follow us. Here we go. Kevin Kelly, thank you for joining me on this podcast.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
I hope you're ready, Kevin, because I'm starting off with a big think question. Science fiction is often marginalized as merely escapism, yet it often tackles deep philosophical issues. What are the naysayers missing?
To me, the science fiction authors and creators of today are our theologians. They're the people who are really wrestling with the great what-if questions and rehearsing the possibilities of what if this happens, what if that happens. And in the biggest senses of the world, are really kind of grappling not just with the political possibilities, but, you know, what does it mean to be human? Where do we fit in the cosmos? I think they're doing all the heavy lifting of the philosophical questions, even as they're doing chase scenes and the usual ingredients that you need for a good story.
Absolutely. Those are the really big questions that science fiction can help us ask ourselves as a species. Obviously, the most direct impact that science fiction has had on humanity can be seen in our technological progress. How would you describe its effect?
I think that what they're doing is expanding possibility space. So we, in the present right now, are kind of bound by what we think is possible. Okay, and so what the science fiction authors are doing is saying, no, it's just, this is a much bigger space than you think where we're going. And things that seem impossible to us at first glance could actually be possible. And so science fiction is sort of in some ways responsible for trying to expand the possibility space as we look around us.
That's such an interesting way of looking at its influence. I'm curious, are there any other specific films you can point to that significantly pushed the possibility space?
It was 2001, I think. It worked its magic, and it was like, I was there, and this is blowing up the possibility space. This did its magic and fundamental education, which is to imagine what the future would be like and to make it somewhat plausible and to inhabit it in some ways. And it's like, yeah, I want more of that.
I mean, 2001 is absolutely such an important touchstone. Other films or television shows or books that you think have had a massive long tail effect on our culture?
Well, I mean, there's no getting around that Star Wars was the fountainhead of so much. And there's lots of reasons for it. I wasn't aware at the time, but one of the ways I would describe it now that Star Wars had a huge effect was the idea of the worn future.
Right.
Okay, so
lived in.
The lived in. Before that moment, everybody's imagination mostly was of this sterile, streamlined, clean, glossy future. And then here was this future that had a kind of a war in history, and it was a little gritty, but it had this live-in aspect, then you'd say, oh, of course. Of course it's going to be worn at the edges and battered. And it was like that kind of changed everything. That opened up this whole other world, and you had, you know, of course, Blade Runner and stuff. And it was just now part of how people thought about the future, that it would have this everyday worn aspect to it. Of course.
Which might be the most science fiction thing about Star Wars, because for the most part, it doesn't posit any new technologies.
Right.
It's more, much more fantasy than science fiction.
It's much more world building, which is another thing that's come out of science fiction, is this idea that you can construct these alternative worlds as a, not just for telling stories, but maybe even as a way to think about the future. It would do better for my purposes of having a richer depiction of what life on this planet is. And the reason why, I think, is that it is very difficult to create a future that is fantastic unless we have an image, unless we have a vision of what that wants to be. And so I think that we need to rebalance our holistic science fiction universe by having more depictions of a world and a future that we really want to live in. And what the opportunity, I think, for a science fiction world today is to restore in that, to have at least some of the vision of imagining a future that's full of artificial intelligence and ubiquitous virtual reality and total tracking and all this other stuff is coming, and yet it's a place that we want to live.
Science fiction futures seem to come in three flavors: utopian, dystopian, and the one you subscribe to, protopian. What does protopian mean?
So there's utopians, which have a view that we can kind of in some ways perfect society, or at least eliminate a lot of the problems. And we have this vision where there is a higher level of harmony in the world in the future. And then there's this dystopians, which are the doom and gloom, which is, you know, this is everything's going to collapse. A protopian, of which I'm a church of one, is this idea that I believe in progress, meaning that things are going to be a little better next year than they were this year, but not by very much.
Right. Yep. And you're willing to accept that.
And we're going to accept that because even if we create only a few percent more than we destroy every year, 1% compounded over centuries is progress. What progress is about all the things that did not happen. It's about all the deaths that did not happen. It's about all the starvation that did not happen. It's about all the times when your food was not stolen by somebody else who was stronger than you. And so, that's not going to show up. That's why progress is sort of invisible, even though it's real. And so part of what we lost maybe in science fiction was a sense of progress. The future actually would be a better place. My position is that most of the problems that we're dealing with today have been caused by technology in the past, and that most of the problems we're having in the future are going to be created by the technology we're creating today. But that the solution to those problems that technology creates is not less technology, but more and better technology. Just as if I was to utter some stupid remark, if I had a bad idea right now, you're not going to tell me, you need to think less.
Right.
You're going to say, you need to have a better idea. And technology is like that. So if there's harm caused by technology, it's not to have less, it's to have more and better. So those solutions that technology brings are themselves going to make new problems. And the solution to those is more and better technology. So we have this cycle of more and more stuff. And so, is that just a wash? No. There's a net gain, because in each cycle, what we're gaining are more and more choices, possibilities, options. And I think that we have a moral duty to increase those options, because every one of us has a unique set of talents and often takes technology to be the vehicle for that expression. So imagine if Mozart, Beethoven had been born 1,000 years before we invented the symphony or the piano. What would have been lost?
Right.
Not just to us, but to them. Imagine if Hitchcock or Lucas had been born 1,000 years before cinema. What would have been lost? So there is a Shakespeare today, somewhere in the world, who's waiting for us to develop her technology so that she could express her genius to us. So we have a moral obligation to increase the amount of possibilities in the world.
You've made the future your business for a long time. Just talk to me about what got you to start Wired magazine. What was the impetus behind what is, you know, maybe the longest lasting futurist magazine?
My fascination with the future came actually when I tried an experiment to live as if I was going to die in 6 months. And I took it very seriously, and I was giving away and surrendering my future all the time. And it came to a point where I realized that actually having a future was part of what made us human, that we actually had to have something to look forward to, or else we weren't really complete beings.
Hmm.
That when you take away that future, we're diminished tremendously, and that there was a essential part of us that was about looking forward. And I became kind of maybe interested in paying that more attention. Of course, as a kid, I read science fiction everywhere, and I was just thinking about it the other day, realizing that at that time in the 50s and 60s, reading science fiction was the only science fiction there was. There was no science fiction movies. There was no real science fiction TV. It was in novels and paperback. I think I became more interested in it as an essential human enterprise, thinking about the future at that moment.
So budding futurist Kevin Kelly at 18, 19, as he thought about the year 2017, how much of what we have today would have been science fiction for him?
Well, nobody then, I think, even imagined the internet. And so this is total science fiction. You know, Siri, Alexa.
Okay, Google.
This is AI.
Yeah.
You know, that was the beginning of everything, because there was this other world.
Right.
Emerging world of bulletin boards and things. Once you had a modem, it was magical. So the standalone computer didn't really change very much. It can make word processing faster, maybe spreadsheets, but that was it. But the computer married to the telephone,
right,
was everything. That was the beginning. That was where this transformation happened. And on the other side of that modem plug, I discovered that there was this emerging world, and that world of technology felt very organic. And I became more and more interested in what else you could do with this flexible, organic network-like stuff.
So you've been at the forefront of a lot of what people later on, sometimes years, sometimes decades later, thought of as science fiction at the moment you were diving into it. Was there a science fiction story, movie, book of your youth that you think helped give you that ability to look at something and see the possible futures?
I think I read science fiction during the classic golden era of what they call hard science fiction now, the Asimovs and Arthur C. Clarke's of the at that time. And I think there was, I think it was short stories that sort of formed my opinion, because they were like scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
One of the official approaches to the future is that you can't really predict it, but you can make scenarios that cover the plausibility space.
Right, right.
And I felt in some senses that reading a lot of short science fiction stories was a little bit of like presenting possible scenarios, and that you couldn't really predict what would happen, but you could cover the plausibility space with enough stories about what might happen.
Right, right. And that helps your predictive abilities.
Right. So
not predictive abilities, but abilities to see where something is leading on a fertile path.
Right. The way scenarios work as a discipline, which is now a discipline, is that, okay, you can't predict the future, but you can certainly predict the plausible boundary of it, knowing that whatever happens has to happen within plausibility. So if you can stake out the corners of what's plausible, then you know that whatever has to happen will happen within those. And then you say, well, what are the driving forces that determine the corners of the future plausibility? And then you can say, what are the early signals that we're moving in this direction versus this direction?
Right.
And then you can identify, well, what are the first signs that we would indicate that we're going down to this plausible corner?
Kevin, we've talked a lot about science fiction in the past and its effect on you as a younger person and growing older and understanding the world. But what do you think about the future of science fiction, where it's going, where it could go, where it should go?
Wow, that's a really great question. I'm very bullish on the potential for virtual reality. I think the power of science fiction will migrate to virtual reality and will become even more powerful. And there's a couple of reasons why I think that. One is the way movies work is that there's a trick that the technology plays on your brain. It's very, very simple, which is that when you're watching the rocket zoom across the screen, the technology tricks your brain to fully believe that that movement is real. But it's not. And VR has a similar trick. And that trick is a little different. It works, again, on a different part of our brain. It's not conscious. It's not the part of brain that we use for reading. And that trick is that when you are in this and can have a full 3D volumetric sensation, your brain is tricked to believe that those are really present. So the common demo for VR is to put you in a room, then they drop the floor away, and you have to walk a plank out into over the cliff.
Yeah.
And you can't do it. Your body is telling you you're going to die. Your legs are shaking. You're sweating. Your brain knows that you're in the same room.
Yeah.
You're just standing there, but you can't do it because your body brain has been tricked into believing that's really present, that you really are there. And that sense of when you take the goggles off, you don't remember having seen something. You remember having experienced it.
But it still requires some storytelling.
It does. And there's these challenges of managing your attention. There'll be a grammar that we'll use to understand those kinds of conventions of how you direct attention, how you manipulate your focus and all those kinds of things to enable us to tell stories where you have a lot more freedom than you do sitting in front of a screen where your head is just pointed forward.
And in the same way that film makes the experience of a possible future or a completely artificial world more immersive than a novel,
right?
Because it's giving you this vision rather than asking you
to
make it. VR is that elaboration one more step.
Right. You're involved in these experiences, and it's become incredibly powerful. So we have this new currency of experience. And I think that when we move into this world where the experiences are the currency, there's going to be an entirely new power of world building and experiencing.
Wow.
And it's going to not just tell stories, but really, really amplify this idea of new possibilities. Not only are these going to be experiences, but these are going to be shared experiences.
Wow, yeah.
We think of the VR, oh, this is guys isolated in their bedroom with their... No.
Yeah.
This is going to be the most social of all the social media. So these experiences you're going to have with other people, with your friends, not just like sitting next to you. No, you're involved with them in these experiences. And it's become incredibly powerful.
I totally agree. This opens up a whole new way to relate to each other.
Right. And I think there will also be things that we will invent in these worlds, because it'd be so easy to invent, that will then come back into the real world.
Fascinating.
So that's, I think, one of the influences that the future of science fiction has, is that we will actually make these things first in these fictional worlds.
Right.
And then bring them back, and people will say, oh, that's really cool. Why can't we have that in real life?
Yeah.
And then people make it in real life.
And all of a sudden the pad in Star Trek becomes our
exactly.
iPad.
Exactly. So it's something you first experience in these worlds in the kind of every way with all the constraints that you can imagine, except it's not made out of metal or atoms. And then you'll say, well, that needs to exist. And so this becomes kind of like the prototype world for where you get to try out the future first.
Right. When you envision the future, do you think that we will eventually be able to colonize more planets within our solar system and then beyond?
Unlike Jeff Bezos and others who are really champion human settlement, I actually think space is for robots. And so I think there's no doubt that we'll have colonies on Mars or whatever, but I think they're going to be tiny outposts like the ones in Antarctica. There will be for scientific research, there'll be difficult and expensive to maintain. We'll get a lot of insights, but I don't see a mass migration because I think it's unlikely to make much sense economically in the long term. So Jeff has this really great phrase. He wants to have a trillion humans so that we can have a million Einsteins. All right?
Yeah.
Which I totally buy into.
Sure.
But I find it really difficult to imagine a trillion humans living in space because it's so brutal on flesh and meat.
Wait, I want to go back to this, your thought about your concept about thinking differently, about looking at things from a different... What do you think is a way that we as average citizens can do that. It's to our benefit to be able to imagine all these different possible futures, both personally and culturally. Do you have ways in which you think that people can better serve thinking differently?
I think one of the easiest ways to do that is to travel far from where you are, to travel in the most remote place that you are comfortable or maybe uncomfortable. And what that forces, one is that they are doing things in a different way, and so you get to see how they're doing it, and that sparks ideas. And then secondly, they're looking back at the things that you know from a completely different angle, and you get to see what you're familiar with in a new light. And I think just the habit of being forced to look at the world from a different window is part of that habit that you want to have about thinking differently. And along the way, you also encounter wholly new ideas that you would simply not ever encounter in your ordinary day-to-day life where you are. And I think the benefits and the virtues and the power of traveling are so powerful that I think we should subsidize it for the young. I believe in that we should have mandatory national service of 2 years for every young person, no exceptions. It's the easiest way to travel to a different planet is to get on an airplane.
Absolutely.
Go to Burning Man, for that matter. That's a different planet. So I think yes, it's you know, if we could travel to other planets, of course, wouldn't that be, that would feed science fiction like nothing else. But here's the thing, you know, it's like one of the things I say is I can't imagine any kind of event that would like disrupt, say, religious belief or political belief even around the world than contact with an ET, right? Mm-hmm. The arrival of some sentient species that was highly evolved and had a civilization would be completely disruptive to all the established religions, because whatever their beliefs were, would be disruptive. Right. It doesn't matter what it is. It was just like, okay, well, who knows when that will happen, if it will happen, but there's absolute certainty that within 50 years, we're going to create artificial aliens on this planet with AIs and robots.
And genetic engineering.
And we're going to have exactly this, they're going to have exactly the same effect on us as if they arrived from another planet. Okay, and so science fiction has been exploring that theological disruption for a very long time.
Yeah.
And we kind of treat it as fiction, as something in the future. But in fact, I think this is really going to happen. We're going to come back to these science fiction stories and start to mine them for, like, well, what do we say to them? How does this work out? What should we be prepared for? How do we rehearse for this? And so I think while we think of science fiction as entertainment, I think it's actually much more powerful than that. I think it's actually has a treasury of deep thinking about what we're going to encounter pretty soon.
Kevin, I can't imagine a better place to stop than right there. Thank you so much for talking. I really appreciate it. As a fellow optimist and now recently converted protopian, thank you. Okay, Kevin, lightning round. Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Wars.
Man or machine?
Machine.
Hal or Siri?
Oh, Hal!
The Upside Down or Middle Earth?
I'm going with Upside Down.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Green juice or Soylent Green?
Soylent Green.
Red pill or blue pill?
Red pill.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, you're welcome. That was fun.
Thanks again to Kevin Kelly, and thanks to you for listening to Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. And be sure to check out our other episodes of this podcast with incredible guests like Chris Hardwick, Sana Aminat, Kevin Smith, and David X. Cohen. For more about the podcast, visit us at sci-fi.com.